From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Highways, railroads, detours, and delays. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. As Memorial Day kicks off another travel season, millions of Americans will find that transportation infrastructure is on the decline. Roads and bridges are crumbling while Congress passes short-term funding that delays long-term repairs and construction. New technology to increase the safety of passenger trains is likely to be postponed despite last week's deadly derailment. As the U.S. falls behind the rest of the world, conservatives blame government incompetence while progressives insist there's just not enough money. Today's talking point, another oil spill, Santa Barbara, California's worst nightmare scenario. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. America's highways and railroads were once the envy of the rest of the world, but they've become decidedly second rate. Meantime, Congress is deadlocked, not just over funding the transportation system, but what its goals should be. Today's talking point, in 1969, a massive oil spill off Santa Barbara, California, kickstarted America's environmental movement. This week's spill is smaller, but it's focused attention on the risks of development in pristine places. First, this news update. The so-called Arab Spring began in Tunisia, where democracy and pluralism are taking root. That's a quote from President Obama and his newly elected counterpart, Baji Cade Essebsi, writing in an op-ed piece in today's Washington Post. The U.S. intends to designate Tunisia as a major non-NATO ally. Tamara Wittes is former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs. She is now Director of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. What does it mean to be a major non-NATO ally?
Well, it's a pretty select group. There are only about 15 countries that fall into this category for the United States, and it doesn't convey the defense obligations that the NATO treaty does, but it does give these countries access to certain sets of benefits. Obviously, it's a symbol of close security partnership. It also lets them participate in certain types of counterterrorism activities, research cooperation with the Department of Defense. But most importantly for most countries, it lets them buy reserve materials that the Department of Defense makes available only to non-NATO allies.
There was a lot of hand-wringing over the GCC summit last week and the failure of the head of Saudi Arabia to show up. You have written that the situation in Tunisia is much more important.
Yes, in many ways, I think today's meeting with President Obama is more important to the future trajectory of the Middle East and North Africa. Because Tunisia is about the future, and the GCC summit is about dealing with the problems of the past, the instability, the conflict, the sectarian arguments that have been plaguing the region. And what Tunisia offers is perhaps not a model, but at least a counterexample, that it's possible for the people of the region to resolve their conflicts peacefully through a democratic political process, through negotiation and compromise, through inclusive coalition government. And as the two leaders said in their joint op-ed this morning, that it shows that democracy is not just possible, but necessary in North Africa and the Middle East. And I think that's an important message at a moment when, for most Americans, their vision of the region is one of conflict and misery.
Certainly, Tunisia, though, is not immune from terrorism. There was an attack in March on the Bardo National Museum in the capital city. Mostly Europeans, European tourists were killed, 21 of them, by Tunisian citizens who were terrorist gunmen.
Absolutely. It was a horrific attack. And it demonstrates something that, of course, we already know, that even democratic societies are not immune from terrorism. Europe has also suffered this year, and of course, we are often facing threats here at home as well. I think that in Tunisia, you definitely have a population, a large number of young people who are well-educated but can't find work and are very frustrated. And in addition, I think that they do have a domestic extremism problem that they are trying to combat. And this fragile democratic transition could very easily be overwhelmed by the forces of extremism that are raging all around Tunisia, but most particularly, of course, in the Libyan civil war right next door.
There have been two national elections now in Tunisia. Have they had to take security measures in order to get people to the polls, or have the elections been peaceful?
The elections have been peaceful. At certain moments over the last couple of years in the midst of their political transition, and especially when they were negotiating the final pieces of their new democratic constitution, the political crisis did get quite polarized, and there were some assassinations of high-profile political leaders. That really did push the country to the brink of conflict. But it was impressive how, looking over the edge of the abyss, Tunisians pulled back, their political leaders pulled back, and they very much don't want to go down the road of a Libya or Syria, and they also don't want to go down the road of an Egypt, which faced political polarization that ended in a military coup and some pretty tough repression.
Very quickly, we just have a couple of seconds left, but you are an expert on the Middle East. What about ISIS now entering the World Heritage Site of Palmyra? Are you concerned that the ancient ruins there might be at risk?
They certainly are at risk if you look at ISIS's record in Iraq. But honestly, the fact that the Western world is more mobilized by the fate of some ruins than by the death of 200,000 Syrians over the last several years should give us all pause.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. And we will, of course, watch to see what happens in both these countries and as the presidents meet at the White House. Tamara Wittes, good to have you with us now at the Brookings Institution.
Thank you.
In a moment, highways and railroads, detours and delays on To the Point.
KCRW's popular iPad Music Mine app is now available for the iPhone. From quick discovery to deep exploration, take KCRW Music with you wherever you go. Download at kcrw.com/musicmine.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. As the summer travel season begins, Congress is mired in long-running disagreements over funding for the Highway Trust Fund and railroad safety. Fawn Johnson is congressional correspondent for the National Journal. Hi, Fawn. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
Let's start with the Highway Trust Fund.
Well, we've gotten to a point where members are willing to kick the can yet again until July 31st. But then after that, they're going to be forced to make some serious decisions. Just earlier this week, the House passed a bill that is expected to pass the Senate sometime today or this weekend that would allow state governments to be able to pull money from the Highway Trust Fund. That was set to expire at the end of this month, and so they are allowed to continue doing that until essentially the money runs out, which is around July 31st. And that was all they were able to manage. They were hoping that they could at least extend it through the end of the year, but that cost some money, and they weren't able to find the offsets.
It runs out? The Highway Trust Fund runs out at the end of July?
Well, yeah. I mean, keep in mind, I guess I should back up a little bit. The Highway Trust Fund is constantly being replenished by us, the users of gas, because it is actually funded through the gas tax. But this is a peak season for construction, which means that there are projects that are ongoing through state transportation departments where they are pulling money from the Highway Trust Fund. So it's kind of it's kind of like they're pulling and then they're reinvesting money at the same time. But the authority to take money from the trust fund had been set to expire, still is, I guess, technically, at the end of this month, May 31st, and which would mean that even if it had a lot of money in it, that state transportation departments could not actually extract money from it to continue their projects. That's a big problem, especially as we're hitting peak construction season. So members of Congress have decided to extend the authority for them to be able to take the money as needed through the end of the summer. But then come July 31st, it really will hit sort of the bottom of the barrel, and so the authority will run out, and they will need to come up with a longer-term solution. They are working on one. It's just that they're having a hard time facing the cost issue.
And you say they've kicked the can once again. This is habitual.
It is kind of habitual. I mean, I've been covering this for about 5 years, and it's been about 10 years since they passed a truly robust long-term highway and transit bill. That was in a different era of Congress when budgets were a little bit looser and when earmarks were allowed. Those are special projects in people's own districts. And that was a five-year bill. It was, you know, almost $300 billion, and it was a big deal. Come 5 years later, we're in the middle of a recession. We're in the middle of, you know, watching the government teeter on the brink, watching the financial crisis happening. And so lawmakers were forced to figure out what to do. And so they wound up doing a few stopgap extensions, kind of what they're doing right now. The best they were able to do was in 2012. They came up with a two-year highway bill, which the reason why it was so short was because they could only find enough money elsewhere in the government budget to fund it. And they're in that same situation now. The only difference is that some of the other, you know, government problems issues have been resolved. We're not looking at a shutdown. And all of the budgeting gimmicks that they had used prior to continue funding the highway and transit program are gone. So now they actually really have to come up with a way to come up with, you know, in the realm of something like $90 billion to extend the Highway Trust Fund Authority for another 5 years. And they are actually looking very closely at different things that they can do. A lot of it involves tax reform, but that's a different conversation than has ever been had in the transportation world. Usually the tax writers and the transportation people don't cross paths very much. So it's taking a little more time than I think anyone expected.
Juan Johnson, again, congressional correspondent for the National Journal. Adi Tomer is associate fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What does it mean when the states can't plan for the long term and they have to build new roads and highways?
You know, states rely on a very significant share from federal spending. But it's important for the national context of this debate, for people who see those construction crews on their roads or on their rails in their market. You know, federal money only represents about a quarter of all spending on surface transportation, meaning, again, roads and rails. So it's really it's an important share. It's not everything. But what helps is that it really incentivizes long-term development. Knowing that money is coming can help pay for bonds to build long-term projects. It gives certainty to certain projects to be built that otherwise folks aren't sure if they can afford. So it's really, really important. When Congress and inside the Beltway kind of sends this signal to states that they're unsure their commitment to the program, it makes planning for projects at the state and local level incredibly difficult. And that's why you're hearing a chorus coming from associations represented here in D.C., from actual actors on the ground across the country. You know, effectively yelling at Washington, saying, please pass a long-term bill, whatever the scoping might be, ideally, of course, as much money as possible. The states benefit from that. So we get a little bit of certainty around these long-term projects. Really quick, I think the important thing to consider versus other policy areas and policy sectors is infrastructure projects take multiple years to build, and they really are an investment in our future, so they last for decades at a time. So having certainty in planning is really, really important.
Is this a good time to raise the primary source of the Highway Trust Fund, which is the gasoline tax?
You know, I think in the short term, it's really the easy solution, effectively. Raising it, and let's say it's about a dime on what's right now, not much, you know, about 18 cents per gallon. With gas rates so low across the country, even in some of our expensive states like California, it's something that consumers can afford. Of course, they're going to take a little bit of a hit on the savings they're seeing right now. But it still it raises a question, right? It's just going to allow us to continue to build and plan for investments the way we've been doing in the past. You know, our big concern here at the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program is we're living in a different century than the legislation we're currently working with, which is from the mid-20th century. It was really about building out highways, and starting in the 1980s, really helping out regions build out transit as well. You know, we need to reevaluate the new century we're in, the kind of productive economy we're looking to build, and in particular when the highway construction boom is over. You know, our key here is maintaining it for interstate commerce, continuing to build out transit and other investments that are good for our general social economic and, importantly, environmental goals we have, but we don't really have a legislative structure right now that's good for that. Raising the gas tax can help us today, but it doesn't really solve our long-term policy questions.
Let me introduce Chris Edwards, economist at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank familiar to our listeners. Chris Edwards, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What about raising the gas tax?
Well, my view is that the solution to our infrastructure challenges, should come from state and local governments, not the federal government. So with the gas tax, for example, you could solve the highway trust fund problem in Washington, maybe by raising the gas tax by 10 cents or so a gallon. But there's really no advantage to that compared to the individual states raising their own gas taxes. So, to the members of Congress who want to raise the national gas tax, I would suggest to them that they lobby their own state legislature to raise its gas tax. If Senator Corker from Tennessee, for example, wants the gas tax higher, well, really, Tennessee can raise its own gas tax whenever it wants. It knows its own highway demands and challenges more than policymakers in Washington do. So I don't see any advantage in centralizing the funding of highway or transit spending. I mean, transit, for example, it is a metropolitan, it is an urban issue, and it seems to me that cities themselves know their own transit challenges better than Washington does. So, I really, the states can solve their infrastructure problems, and many of them are, moving ahead in various ways. Right now, with either gas tax increases or more public-private partnerships, the solutions are out there. We don't need Washington involved in all these decisions.
Adi Tomar, what do you say to that?
Well, I mean, certainly since these general fund infusions began in 2008, which is what Fawn was talking about at the beginning of this segment, we've seen folks living in states that represent over half of the U.S. population that have either raised their gas tax or are about to raise their gas tax. In other words, they're talking about in legislative their own state legislative chambers. So in some ways, that really reinforces Chris's point. He's absolutely right. 75% of infrastructure spending on roads, rails, and including water infrastructure, it comes from states and localities. So they are the key actor here. So in that sense, we do want to see states still incentivize their own development. He's absolutely right. Chris and I agree that metropolitan and urban areas know what's best for their local economies to become more productive, offer more equality of opportunity for their residents and businesses, and what kind of environmental justice they want to see on the ground too.
So why should they be dependent on Washington then?
Well, I think what I'm saying is they're not dependent on Washington, but Washington's a key actor in this kind of grand, beautifully tasteful soup, right, that we have to build infrastructure in this country. And there's a few key things that D.C. does need to do. Where I explicitly push back on Chris is that they need to lead on freight, which is essentially trade within and outside this country, interstate commerce, right? It's actually in the Constitution. 77% of goods in this country cross state lines. So arguments about what's quote-unquote devolution in this space are really effectively, which is, I think, more than Chris is asking for, but essentially removing the interstate system and support for it, goes completely against the interests of businesses and residents across the country. They need a federal actor to make sure goods can move from, let's say, Seattle, Washington to Miami, Florida. But there's also an opportunity here for the federal government to empower, let's say, by providing interstates more opportunity to toll. And most importantly for us also is the ability to leverage certain resources they have to see better development on the ground, exactly like states and metros want to produce on their own. This can be through through loan guarantees have a soup of acronyms. One of them is called TIFIA, but it's also incentivizing specific programs through competition. It's what we really like to see in the transit program. It's why we also support a smaller grant program known as TIGER that incentivizes specific projects from regions. That kind of competition bubbles up good ideas and makes sure the federal government is actually using their relatively, that 25% size role to bring out really, really good development across the country.
Okay, well, we'll get back to Chris Edwards in a moment for a response on the need for a nationwide federal program dealing with transportation. First, though, let me go back to Fawn Johnson on the issue of railroad safety. We had this fatal passenger train crash outside of Philadelphia. That has brought attention to funding problems with regard to rail safety as well.
Yeah, that has, and that's probably the one silver lining from that horrible accident is that for the first time since I've been covering transportation, people are talking about rail safety in a way that the country is paying attention. The issue with rail safety, though, gets a little bit tricky because there's two issues about why it is not as the railroads are not as safe as we would like them to be right now. One of them involves money, and who spends it, and the other one involves the actual building of this complicated network of trains talking to one another, and also monitors on the rail, and then the actual radio airwaves that are communicating with them. This is a technique called positive train control that was authorized and by Congress back in 2008, but it was just getting developed at the time. And the reason why this has been in the news, of course, is because had that particular piece of rail where this accident was north of Philadelphia had positive train control in place, it probably would have stopped that accident from happening because it is supposed to detect when trains are going too fast.
And a deadline was set for positive train control that's going to expire very soon, but now Congress may extend it. Is that right?
That's correct. There's a couple of different ways to look at it, but where it gets complicated is that when Congress first authorized this in 2008, they said we want all rail to have this positive train control in place by the end of 2015, and that effectively means that you're asking the freight rail companies, which own most of the rail around the country, and Amtrak, which owns the stretch of rail from Washington, D.C. all the way to Boston, the Northeastern Corridor, you're asking them to spend their own money to put this into place. And, and this is billions of dollars. I believe that the freight rail company that put something like $6 billion into instituting this, some companies more than others. But the issue is that, especially when it comes to Amtrak, they spent the first several years just fighting with the Federal Communications Commission about whether they could even own the band of radio airwaves that they would need to have this kind of communication take place. So even if they had the money, they weren't able to institute it right at the beginning. So this is the reason why a lot of lawmakers have been supportive of the idea of extending the deadline, because they realize that they had set the deadline before they knew where all of the hurdles would be towards putting it in place.
What would happen if they didn't extend the deadline?
That's also a question. I mean, when you have a deadline put in place and people don't meet it, generally there's some kind of punishment that comes forward, but they could have waivers for that as well. And there was I was talking to one member of Congress who the ranking Democrat on the House Transportation Committee, Pete DeFazio from Oregon, knows a lot about trains and he's a big supporter of Amtrak. And he was suggesting that instead of actually just blanket extending the positive train control deadline until 2020, which is what a lot of lawmakers have proposed, was that you actually kind of go in and parse it out. And so you look at, say, Burlington Northern and say, okay, how far have you gone in terms of this? And
do it on an individual basis.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to continue this conversation after we take a very brief break on our talking point later. The latest oil spill evokes memories of something that happened in the past, a terrible environmental disaster in Santa Barbara, California in 1969. We'll hear about that back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking today about America's transportation infrastructure. We've heard a bit about the Highway Trust Fund, where that stands, and also about the positive train control system, which was mandated by Congress in 2008 but hasn't been installed yet. Casey Dinges is Senior Managing Director of the American Society of Civil Engineers. That is a member-supported nonprofit. Casey Dinges, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for the invitation.
How bad is the situation in the United States with regard to roads and particularly trains as opposed to other developed countries?
You know, we put out a report card in 2013. We've put those out every 4 years since 1998. We looked at 16 categories of infrastructure, so the ones you're talking about and others, you know, levees, aviation systems, ports. And we gave the nation an overall grade of a D+, which was a slight improvement from the D in 2009. And then actually six of the categories, including rail, by the way, and I should add bridges, there were some improvements. I think it was making the point that as investments are made, you know, these grades can improve. To your question, though, about, you know, how the United States matches up with some of our competitors, it is interesting. A report just a couple years ago by McKinsey Global Institute indicated that China is investing almost 9% of its GDP in infrastructure. Japan, a mature nation, is still investing close to 5%. Europe is down, Western Europe in particular, down near where the U.S. is at about 2.6%. I will say about 10 years ago, Europe was still about double the United States. So we're at a level of 2.6% of our GDP. We did an economic study called the Failure to Act, which found that if the U.S. were to just increase investment by 1% of GDP, which is about $150 billion a year between now and 2020, the U.S. could actually protect $3 trillion in GDP, $1 trillion in U.S. trade value, 3.5 million jobs, $2.5 trillion in consumer spending. So it is a huge economic risk for the United States to continue to mosey along with very mediocre grades across all these infrastructure categories.
When you say U.S. spending, does that include state spending as well as federal spending?
Yes, absolutely. And the previous discussion indicated the federal role at about 25% in the transportation sector. And to the comment that Chris had made previously about, you know, states versus federal, a number of states recently have increased user fees. A number of red states, I might add, have been having these debates and taking this action. But it's with the belief and understanding that Washington will do its role and step forward and for the first time in two decades look at its user fees and finally adjust them to inflation and have something that can really meet, you know, 21st century needs. So it's not an either or. The states and the feds are partners in this.
Let me go back to Chris. It's Chris Edwards, economist at the Cato Institute. What about this? And given the extraordinary stakes with trillions of dollars involved in GDP and trade and consumer spending, isn't it time to get going?
Well, I would say this. There's a big difference between the dollars you spent and the efficiency of that investment. We want both dollars spent and we want highly efficient investment. And let's go back to rail for a minute and contrast freight rail versus passenger rail. Since freight rail was privatized and deregulated in the United States in the 1980s, it has been a huge success. We've had lots of competition. We've had lots of investment by the private rail companies. Freight rail has been an enormous success for the U.S. economy. By contrast, passenger rail is run as a government monopoly, and it has not been successful. Why? Because Congress makes it so that a lot of the Amtrak investment goes to states and rail lines that are little used and are only there because of congressional pork barrel politics. So I think the solution for rail is privatization. In Britain, for example, privatized their passenger rail in the 1990s, and then it's been a big success. Rail ridership has gone up in Britain. Many new rail companies came in. Richard Branson, the famous entrepreneur, opened some rail lines. So I think for people who support passenger rail, I think they have to be thinking about getting entrepreneurs back into American passenger rail. And I think that would lower costs, improve quality, and I think it could potentially in the long run, you know, increase passenger use, private rail. Passenger rail use in the United States, which would benefit everyone. So, you know, you have to think that there is a difference between the dollar spent and the efficiency of that investment.
Let me go back to Adi Tomer at the Brookings Institution, associate fellow with the Metropolitan Policy Program. What do you say to that?
Yeah, well, the rail system in the country is really a story of two halves. And sorry, I'm speaking to the passenger rail side. Chris is absolutely
sure.
Right. We have, by all accounts, the most successful freight rail system in the world. So really, all accounts there, we're doing great. On the passenger rail side, what we really have is a relic of an old system where we've required, effectively, Amtrak to run trains, on our example, from Seattle to Chicago or L.A. to New Orleans. Those kind of distances in the modern kind of era, technologically speaking, folks are mostly going to fly, more possibly drive. And those lines alone lose about $500 million a year in operations. Now, on the flip side, the short-haul corridors where rail makes sense, which is kind of my natural pushback on Britain or France or Germany or Italy, these great systems, Japan, of course, that work really well, is they're really just connecting metropolitan areas over distances between maximum 400 to 500 miles, where rail really works. It takes you to downtown areas, so it's more efficient on time and space in terms of where you depart and arrive from. Those lines in the United States are actually close to an operating profit. They are slightly above it. So, again, there's still capital needs and things of that nature. But all of those systems continue, all those, excuse me, international systems, they continue to receive subsidies. There's a massive misnomer in infrastructure spending in general, as if subsidies aren't needed. Subsidies are actually a good thing. It's us as a collective society saying this is important for business. It's important for us as consumers. It's important for us as families to be able to get to the park or shopping or, again, possibly to work. So we want to collectively pay for things. The key is that we invest wisely. That's where I think Chris and I definitely agree. We might have different ideas about what to invest in. The key is that how do we think through to design a system, whether it's in passenger rail, air traffic in general, highways and transit, that reflects the 21st century that we live in today, right? And make transformative investments, especially in our metropolitan areas, that will reflect where we want to go, and kind of do our part in this era where we're really currently living on the transformative major investments that were made by our previous generations.
Okay. Let me interrupt you for a moment and go back to Casey Dinges with the American Society of Civil Engineers. Do you, in your assessments and grades, with America getting a D+, take into consideration the kinds of things that we're talking about here? And what are we missing out on in the United States when we have a D+ grade that they are getting in other places?
Well, you know, we're just putting the economy at risk. We really, you know, can't have a strong national economy, and for that matter, support a strong national defense unless we have, you know, the infrastructure, the underpinnings of those foundational systems for the United States. And it is a mix. You know, we looked at 16 categories in the report card, and as we've heard from the discussion, in some cases the private sector is the stronger player. In other cases, though, the public sector is still the major player. We focus a lot on rail. There are two other complementary systems to rail on surface in this country, and that is the inland waterway system. There's heavy public involvement, yet we have, you know, locks that are way past their design life there. And then also the highway and bridge system, again, a partnership between different levels of government. There are efforts at more public-private partnerships in some states more than in other states. Some of our competitors may be better leaders in that area. And then also, I think research and technology is something that can still, you know, serve us well in this space. So it is a debate, but I think the bottom line on the investment side is that at all levels of government, investments really need to be going up.
Let me go back to Chris Edwards at the Cato Institute. What about public-private partnerships? Is that something that you're in favor of?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is an area of commonality between your experts today and I think many experts looking at infrastructure. I mean, there has been a global movement toward public-private partnerships and privatization with some of major infrastructure assets. So, for example, I mentioned Britain. Britain in the 1980s privatized most of their seaports. In the United States, most of our seaports are owned by state and local governments. The British seaport privatization experience was usually positive, and I think that's something we ought to look at in this country. There has been a movement to move toward PPPs for highway projects in places like Britain and Canada and Australia. We've had some of that in this country. In Virginia and Texas, there's been successful projects. And, you know, the idea is to get more private money involved in these long-term investments.
Okay, let me go back to Fawn Johnson, again, congressional correspondent for the National Journal. Private investment is one thing, but what's happening in Washington? And is there any indication that there might be some sort of consensus, particularly with the Highway Trust Fund about to run out?
I think there is a consensus that, and this is unusual to see this among Republicans and Democrats, that they want to solve the problem long term. So they don't want to do a 2-year bill like they did in 2012. They want a 5 to 6 year bill with as much money as they can put into it, that the to keep keep the federal level about as it has been would cost about $89 billion. The president, I should add, wants $478 billion, which we could definitely use. So, but they need to figure out how to pay for it. So the issue is really just how do they get there? And the tax writers, the Ways and Means Committee on the House side and the Finance Committee on the Senate side are involved in some pretty intense discussions about the art of the possible. So there is a possibility that we could see some sort of tax package come together. One of the places where they're talking about raising some money that could go into the infrastructure plan is in a way that the tax code treats overseas profits that are incurred by U.S. companies. But that's all, that gets into tax reform, and with the problem with tax reform is once you start pulling on one thread, lots of others come apart. So it's been interesting to watch just the two conversations coming together. But I think it will happen, and I think it will happen in the next couple of months. And if it doesn't, you know, people keep still bringing up the idea of raising the federal gas tax. Republicans generally say no to that, but when faced with no other option, that might be another thing to look at.
Casey Dinges, back to you with the American Society of Civil Engineers. You take a look at this issue over time. If there isn't some increased investment relatively soon, what do you anticipate?
Well, again, you know, the U.S. GDP will be compromised. U.S. ability to trade robustly. I mean, the amount of jobs that will be impacted. It just... You know, Bernie Sanders had a great line. He's running for president. He talks about the infrastructure a lot. It's interesting. And he said he had a very good metaphor. He said it's like a cavity. You really want to put off dealing with it, but if you do, you're just going to pay more down the road. And we've had all these lessons. I mean, you know, look at Katrina in New Orleans. If, you know, if people and government had just been a little smarter about making some wiser investments, huge damage could have been prevented. The same thing up in New York with Superstorm Sandy. So I think it's wise if we can look at these as investments and less as a cost of government.
Okay. There's obviously a tremendous disagreement on this. Let me go to our two other guests and ask you as briefly as possible to tell us if you think there's reason for hope. Adi Tomer, first to you with the Brookings Institution.
Well, it's tough to have optimism, to speaking to Fahn's point, that it's really been since 2005 that we've seen a long-term bill. But, you know, Congress is both discussing this. Fahn is absolutely right that they're both saying the right things, certainly on the policy side, that the need for investment. Massive disagreements, though, on the funding side, the revenue. And that's a big current in D.C. in general. So, you know, if we can kind of figure that out and maybe backs need to be pushed up against the wall, there's a lot of hope. But I think for listeners, I think the big thing to expect is that if we don't see changes as we get closer and closer, as crazy as it sounds to talk about it already, the 2016 presidential, then chances are things aren't going to move because no one's going to want to talk about raising a gas tax or another revenue source. So really the time is now, especially before July or maybe a few months after into the end of the calendar year in December. That's where we're going to see action.
Okay.
After that, it starts to get a little treacherous.
Chris Edwards at Cato.
Very quickly, I'll give your listeners some hope. There were some fascinating Senate hearings on Wednesday about our air traffic control system, which is another very important part of our infrastructure. And there is gelling some real broad agreement on the need for major restructuring in the way we do air traffic control in this country. And again, there's some foreign models like Canada and Britain that are really they've really moved ahead and are showing the United States the direction to go. And there's some really broad-based agreement that we need this restructuring on air traffic control, and it could make great have great benefits for reducing aviation costs in this country. So that's a positive.
So, Casey Dinges, we've talked a lot about highways and railroads, not so much about airports and ports. Are those areas where you think things are better than the ground transportation?
Well, in the report card, ports got a C. They're, you know, that's one of the better grades on the report card. Aviation, though, got a D. And, you know, it's just been, this build out of the next generation air traffic control system is taking a long time and is quite expensive. Although, you know, air safety, you know, that's a sensitive issue for the public. So it'll be interesting to see how the debate goes on, you know, privatizing that system. But all options really, you know, should be on the table. I think people should kind of loosen up. But as someone alluded to earlier, when you think about the investments of previous generations we're living off of, like the investments that helped, you know, the United States get through the historic Mississippi River flood in 2011. And those investments prevented $150 billion in metropolitan area damage.
Okay.
What are the investments that this generation is going to be willing to make for the next century?
All right. Once again, Memorial Day is coming up, and people are going to be on the road, including members of Congress, on the road in the air. We'll see what happens before they leave and when they get back. Casey Dingus with the American Society of Civil Engineers, Chris Edwards with the Cato Institute, Adi Tomer with the Brookings Institution, and Fawn Johnson with the National Journal. Thank you all very much for being with us. This week's oil spill is being called a worst nightmare scenario by officials in Santa Barbara, California. It's evoking memories of the major disaster that helped start the environmental movement in 1969. We'll have more about that in a moment on To the Point.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Alnerback with today's Talking Point. Tuesday's oil spill near Santa Barbara is giving us images of dead birds and cleanup crews and miles, 9 miles of California coast, some of which is covered with thick black oil. The spill is said to be about 21,000, maybe 105,000 gallons. But for Southern California, there are echoes in those images of a much larger spill in 1969, which dumped 3 million gallons of crude oil. That spurred the modern environmental movement and motivated some activists to run for higher office, one of them California's Democratic Congressman Lois Capps. Yesterday, I spoke with her about her memory of that 1969 blowout.
I was a young mom raising my kids in Goleta then. I can remember taking them to the beach that we loved to, where they loved to play, and seeing the heartsick feeling, and still I can call that up, of those seabirds coated with oil trying to move with the waves of oil coming in from the ocean. It was just the worst nightmare that you would ever want to impose upon a place.
Democratic Congressman Lois Capps represents Santa Barbara and other parts of Southern California. Paul Rellis was a student at the University of California, Santa Barbara, in 1969, and he remembers flying over that 35-mile-long oil slick. He's now author of Out of the Wasteland, Stories from the Environmental Frontier. Paul Rellis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
Tell us a bit of what you remember, what it looked like from the air.
Well, I found myself in a small plane. I wasn't the pilot, fortunately. And the pilot bent his wing so I could get a direct view, almost directly down, looking on this massive artesian well of oil upwelling out of the bottom of the ocean.
So this was out at sea on one of the oil drilling rigs, is that right?
Correct. Platform A. Which was the name of the Union Oil platform.
Now, what happened on shore?
Well, on shore, of course, at the time of the spill, when it washed ashore the whole coastline from roughly the Santa Barbara breakwater to Carpinteria, was blanketed in oil. And what had been this vital beachfront now seemed dead.
How would you compare today's situation to what you saw in 1969?
Well, I haven't personally seen the spill. I was out of town when it happened, but the images I've seen are very reminiscent of what happened, though at a much, much smaller scale. And it just brings back all the memories of what that experience was like.
What was it like for young people such as yourself? And I think that it is often said the environmental movement began here. You were part of it.
Yes, I was. Like many young people at that time, it was, of course, a very different time, a turbulent time in our area with the war going on and the activism and all the cultural changes afoot. This just seemed to fit into the mix of the turmoil, and in my case and in many other young people's cases, the response was, we've got to do something to keep this from happening again, and we've got to find an alternative to oil.
Okay, we're still working on that. Meantime, there still is oil drilling offshore of Santa Barbara, and there was the pipeline onshore that broke this week. So that's because leases remain in effect, even though there's now a moratorium on drilling. Is that right?
Yes. I'm not an expert on the current status of those leases, but that's the legacy of offshore oil exploration and development that we continue with today. And we have all the pipeline infrastructure onshore, and I'm told we may be seeing shipments of fracking gas coming through Santa Barbara on rail. So we're very much in the mix of the modern oil exploration and development.
Paul Rellis, again, veteran of the oil spill of 1969, author of Out of the Wasteland, Stories from the Environmental Frontier. Miyoko Shikoshita is the Oceans Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, which is assessing the damage of this week's spill. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What can you tell us, in, particularly in comparison to what we've just heard from Paul Rellis about what happened in 1969?
Well, it was just devastating when the black, sticky oil completely covered the coastline from the blowout that happened in 1969. And, you know, we saw that America was angered at that time, and it did. It gave us now what we have is one of our most powerful tools passed in the aftermath of the 1969 spill, the Clean Water Act, which is now keeping waters clean in other parts of the nation and all across the nation. And while there, you know, was for a time a moratorium on drilling, now companies are still increasing the amount of drilling that they have offshore in California. And as was mentioned, we know that there's fracking happening in those wells offshore, which increases the risk of another dirty oil spill to happen off the coast of Santa Barbara here.
Who's in charge, the federal government or the state?
They both are. There's fracking and drilling that's happening in both state waters and in federal waters. And while there aren't any new leases that are available off the coast of California, those companies that have leases already are still increasing their activities out there and still producing oil. So oil drilling is dangerous, and it's something that we should really be, you know, this is aging infrastructure that's been there since the 60s and 70s. This stuff should be retired instead of increasing its flow. And we saw that today at the risks of offshore drilling and drilling for these dirty fossil fuels.
We don't know yet. We haven't been given a cause for the break in the pipe that's actually on the coast, 24-inch pipe that broke this week and apparently stayed broken for about 3 hours with roughly 50,000 gallons an hour pouring out of it. It was installed by Plain Pipeline, which is a Texas company. What do you know about their safety record?
Well, we've been looking into Plains Pipeline, which is actually one of the largest companies putting in oil and gas pipelines across the country. And what we've found is that they have a history of incidents, most of which are oil spills. They've had over 175 incidents nationwide since 2006. And that includes 11 in California, which included, some people may remember, the oil spill in the neighborhood in L.A. that gushed oil all over that, all over the streets there. And Plains Pipeline, they've had many federal enforcement actions initiated against them in recent years. And, you know, their track record includes many instances as well of corrosion in their pipes and not maintaining them well and having procedures that aren't the right ones in place to make sure that they're safe and that they're not spilling.
Let me go back to Paul Rellis. You, once again, went through the 1969 event. Tell us about the impact on animals in the sea, in the air, and on land.
Well, I think that the impacts were first identified, obviously, the fish and bird life. People who walked ashore tried to help. It was a rather pathetic response because a large oil spill hadn't happened, and people simply didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to try to clean birds. Could they do it? Most of them died. And the legacy of that was debated for years afterwards, even after, long after the cleanup. What was the toll taken on marine life along the Santa Barbara shores? I don't think there's ever been a definitive outcome. Perhaps our guest knows more than I.
Let me ask her, Miyoko Sakashita, with the Center for Biological Diversity, what can you tell us about what happened in 1969? What are you worried about that might happen again now?
Right. Well, I took my family just last year down to Refugio State Beach, and we were camping in that area. And it's just devastating to think of the, you know, wildlife impacts now, and even the harms to people. You know, these petroleum, when crude oil spills out, it creates toxic air fumes, and people have to stay away from the beach. But the impacts on wildlife are particularly startling. You know, back in the 1969 spill, there were thousands of seabirds that were killed. I think over 3,000 seabirds. There were impacted elephant, seals, and sea lions, and obviously much of their habitat. And now what they're finding, they've already found a dead pelican, and several other pelicans have been taken to rehab whose coats are just covered in this oily, sticky mess. The Santa Barbara Channel is a really important bird habitat for many species, including the endangered western snowy plover. And what happens with seabirds is their feathers get coated in oil, and it makes them hypothermic, and then they can take it back to their nests and spread the oil all around. Many other wildlife are also affected potentially by oil. They've seen so far a humpback mom and calf swimming near the oil slick. Dolphins are potentially in the area, and we know.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to interrupt you as you list the damage that is occurring right now as we speak because of the oil spill off Santa Barbara. Thank you both. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast, co-production, KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.